There's an effort underway in Kansas City to join cities nationwide in naming a street after Martin Luther King Jr. This has actually come up more than once in the past. For a while, there was some political momentum behind renaming Prospect. But right now, there's a major push to rename the Paseo, a winding historic boulevard running north and south the whole length of the city just east of Troost, to call that street Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Here's the Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, president of the local chapter of the SCLC, explaining why that movement matters to him.
This goes beyond race. It is organically tied to issues of racial justice, racial identity, and the contributions of a black man to the broader society.
I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And now we're going to get some different perspectives on Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevards, both nationwide and here in town. Call 816-235-2888 with your take on this. We'll start with Anita Dixon. Anita's a historian and commentator who's led civil rights tours of Kansas City in the past. Anita, what are your thoughts about renaming the Paseo after Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, as a historian, I hesitate to say that there shouldn't be a street named after MLK. It's just that I take a particular instance with the Paseo. As it does run completely through the city and goes to various parts, I think that the opportunity to rename, if we were to rename a street of any kind, would have to follow the civil rights movement of Kansas City's history.
Interesting.
In 1968, you know, it started at Central High School and moved down 31st Street and Linwood. And I think that there's more of an opportunity to commemorate and understand more about who MLK was, is, and honoring him in this city than it would be to take a main boulevard that has its own historic roots and change it and change the name of it. I think there's more opportunity in doing in redirecting the MLK than it would be to take a historic street such as the Paseo and changing the name.
So you want it to be someplace that takes us to a significant site in our own local civil rights history?
Absolutely.
Such as?
Such as Central High School in 1968 when the riots started. You know, there were a bunch of people who were in high school and they walked out and they started walking down Linwood, walking down 31st Street is what I understand, and ending up, you know, and the rioting and various things. That's more of a route than saying, let's take this historic Paseo that was known for its gardens and the various things that way the turn of the century, 60 years before the civil rights movement or more, and the various history that was part of the Paseo, the layout of the parks and recreations, as it were. Let's commemorate them both. The history of them both are very important to the city.
Do you think that not having a boulevard named after Dr. King says something about us as a city?
I do. I do. Not having a boulevard, a street, a gathering place, more or less, says that this city continues to negate what is going on racially and what is going on as a city socially, that we would not join in the rest of the nation and other parts of the world who have named things and boulevards and streets and situations after this great man and the history that he provided to us, particularly as Americans. I think that is a real shame that we're not doing that. Unfortunately, I think it's a little misdirected.
So I want to hear a little more about the pro side on the Paseo. I want to play a clip. This is Ken Baucus. He was on Up to Date earlier this month giving his take on why the Paseo is a good choice. Ken is the president of the Urban Summit.
We think the Paseo embody the spirit and peacefulness of Dr. King and what he stood for. And we think that's the appropriate place because every 10 blocks or so, the Paseo creates a different culture. There's a different groups of people.
So, Anita, what do you have to say about that? Because the idea of, it seems like that idea is more about making sure that all people in the city or the greatest variety of people maybe traverse that boulevard, encounter it.
I think that's a wonderful way to look at it. But I also believe that because of the history that still is part of Kansas City. You know, the Paseo does that already. You know, that is a wonderful opportunity to stroll and see the different neighborhoods. But we also, by the time you get to the end of the Paseo, we've got various things that are going on, too, like the old Bendix plant and various things like that. There's things negative and positive we can bring in on that. But I also believe that Martin Luther King, because there is an opportunity to educate more generations and various things, let's take it from a context of history and a tour and an opportunity to stroll down the places. And Leon Jordan's statue is located, you know, on the route of there.
Bernard Tell us more Powell. About him and that statue.
Well, the statue is important because he was part of Kansas City's civil rights history and was assassinated, as was Bernard Powell, who was here and was assassinated. We have people all over the country that actually joined hands with Martin Luther King and met their same fate the same way. I think that as we honor Martin Luther King, let's bring people into communities that are blighted, that could use the help, that could has community gardens and various things like that, and walk them the route of people like Viola Liozzo, who lost her life. You know, that if we could make these things be understood, it wouldn't just be just a street that denotes that. There would be activities, there would be things to do to be certain that people would always remember.
At a public forum last night, one person stood up to say it should be 63rd Street because it crosses even more different communities than the Paseo does, running east and west. But at that same forum, a woman named Maggie Green stood up to suggest Prospect. There was actually a push for that back in the 90s, and it didn't get a lot of support because people thought of that street as maybe run down and were concerned that it wouldn't properly honor Dr. King. But this is Maggie's take on why Prospect would be a good choice.
If you were to do a select a street to change the name, I would highly recommend changing Prospect because it runs from north to south, east to west. It has easy access. Then on top of that, rather than do that, then that way, that would give the city incentive to beautify, Prospect, and restore it.
Do you think, Anita, that the renaming of a street after Martin Luther King Jr. could be seen as an incentive for the city to improve a street?
If there were enough people that understood what Prospect was in the past. I can remember being a child here and taking Prospect all the way, or what was the old I-70 does, all the way to Arkansas. So these are the various things that I agree with her, again, in a sense. If there were to be anything or any direct route that would make more sense than Paseo, would be Prospect. But because, again, of the history, because, again, that we'd be, you know, obliterating what was in order to put something there when there's more opportunity other places, kind of, you know, what's the problem with renaming 31st Street? I mean, not a lot. You know, it's 31st Street. Linwood was named, I understand, after a tree. So we have these types of things that if we consider the history of
the history, not of just of the place, but of the name that currently exists.
Of the name that currently, you know, Prospect is what it was. You know, it was the prospective way to take a look at building something in the community and various things like that. I just, you know, like I said, as a historian, it's hard for me to separate those two when I know there is other opportunity. If all we claim to do is want to commemorate this man, then there are dozens of streets and opportunities and things that surround the history that can do that.
Someone else at this forum stood up and suggested a community center or park, something people could use. But Brian Wilson, who was also there, disagreed.
I am in favor of Paseo, and I have certain reasons why. I've heard about buildings being renamed. We've had schools being named. We had Martin Luther King Middle School. It's been closed down. We had Martin Luther King Hospital. It's been closed down. How many buildings are we going to name after him? And then how long do we know is the building going to still be standing?
Anita, I feel like I know what your response to the question of the particular street is, because we've already talked about that. But what about this question of What about a place with a particular kind of function like a community center? Or do you see it kind of the way Brian sees it?
I do see it the way Brian sees it, because as we, as a city, sometimes it's a necessity to change things, but Kansas City has a tear down fever. And if it runs through something that they don't think is very important, it would probably want to be one of the first things to go. But again, look at 12th Street. We've got a beautiful park that intersects 12th Street to the Paseo. Right there in the middle of the 12th Street Park, if you go down there, the Going to Kansas City Park that was built in 2005, it's like this empty pedestal that's there. Just why can't that be a Martin Luther King, you know, the connection between the Paseo and Troost in the east side? Why can't that be there? I've studied this thing since it started happening and thinking, now here's a wonderful commemoration in this park that brings these communities together, the highway, all of those things. Why can't we just do a commemorative here in this beautiful space on 12th Street?
What's the answer to that?
I don't know. The answer is that people get something in their minds, and people who head the situation want that their things, and nobody else considers that there are other options if, in fact, what they want to do is commemorate this great man, if that's what the real reason that they're doing this is.
Let's talk to Bob in South Kansas City. He's called 816-235-2888 to give his two cents on the renaming of something in Kansas City after Martin Luther King Jr. Right now, there's a lot of momentum and passion behind the Paseo. Bob in South Kansas City, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I heartily applaud the effort. Dr. Martin Luther King needs to be honored multiple times. I don't see any reason why we have to honor really only one place or one street, or a park. Why not both? But beyond that, my thought is that it's an argument that I've had with people from out of town many times, that Martin Luther King, that we are not free unless all of us are free, goes back to them, various other political thinkers, and Martin Luther King made us all much freer, and he, I think, it just makes more sense to me that it be an east-west street, because it would bind the city together, black and white, and which is what I think Dr. King would have ultimately wanted, both communities bound together in a new sense of freedom, trying to understand each other and trying to make this world a better place. I've seen too many Martin Luther King streets in Memphis, in other southern cities that are blighted. I mean, you can almost tell that. And I love the Paseo. I mean, Julia Lee wrote, I don't know, I guess we could rename Julia Lee's Paseo stomp, Dr. Martin Luther King stomp, but she recorded that in 29. But
yeah, and she's not here anymore.
No, she's not here anymore, but she's a Kansas City star.
She is. Well, Bob, that I love these comments and want to give Anita Dixon a chance to reply, but thank you so much for calling.
I really appreciate Anita, and I appreciate her historic outlook. People are ringing my door. I have to go.
Okay, bye, Bob.
Now, exactly, east and west. You know, our classic problems and racism and coming together and, you know, gentrification and various things that are facing the city, you know, with this is an east and west situation. And every time I hear things about that, this is an opportunity for the city to recognize the heritage, recognize opportunity, even economic development opportunity, whether you believe it or not. Because if there is going to be a true movement towards this, that it needs to be that it is encompassed with education and an opportunity to do connect tourism with those things, because every state in the union has some type of situation that surrounded them naming something MLK.
Let's talk to Noland in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Nolan.
Hey, Gina. How are you?
Good. What do you want to share?
Yeah, I live on the Paseo. I've only lived on the Paseo for about a month now, but it definitely has a lot of its own history, and I think renaming it takes away from that. I think we really should consider renaming J.C. Nichols Parkway and the J.C. Nichols Memorial Fountain.
Renaming those after Martin Luther King Jr.
That's right.
Ooh, that's bold. Anita.
That's very bold. I'd like to meet you. I can't really say the history of something ties something to something else. When you begin to obliterate that history, you begin to not understand where that might have been. Where a J.C. Nichols, who traveled all over the world and bought back this incredible fountain, even though he was an incredible redliner and segregationist and various things like that, that's the history. It is what it is. And because it is what it is, we're able to trace some of the things that we've done incorrectly and maybe trace that back. I would think that would be a really cool thing to think about. Whether it would be a success or not, I think you get a lot of pushback, but it's something to think about. But we've got enough.
I'm Gina Kaufman. In just a minute, we'll be bringing a photographer who's visited and documented MLK Boulevards nationwide. She's going to share her perspective, and you can keep sharing yours at 816-235-2888 on KCUR Central Standard. We're back. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're discussing the movement to rename the Paseo after Martin Luther King Jr. so that Kansas City can join cities nationwide in having a Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard somewhere in town. But that's controversial, and there are a lot of people who support other streets, other locations, including Anita Dixon, who's here with me. She's suggesting 31st or Linwood. Anita, hello again.
Hello.
Let's turn now to Susan Berger. She's a photographer who's been documenting Martin Luther King Jr. boulevards all over the country. And Susan, first of all, what inspired you to do this?
Well, actually, I was finishing up another photography project, trying to decide what I was going to do next. I was in a rural area and came across a sign pointing to Martin Luther King Drive. And I was astounded. I had always seen Martin Luther King Drive in urban areas, and here I was amongst the corn. And so I wanted to see what it looked like. And it was then that I decided to travel around the country and see what they, as many as I could, look like. There's something like 700 Martin Luther Kings. I did not see them all.
But tell me about that Martin Luther King Drive in the cornfield.
Well, it wasn't in the cornfield.
Okay.
It was in the town related to the cornfield. I think it's, I've enjoyed listening to Anita's conversation about the looking at the historical aspect. In my travels, I would say 99% of the Martin Luther King Drive boulevards, whatever, that are not a section of the freeway, are in a black neighborhood, run through the black neighborhood. And it's my understanding from my readings that this has been a choice of many civil rights leaders, that they want the street in the neighborhood where the residents live that were most affected by Dr. King. The other side of the argument, as you have pointed out earlier, is to have the street in an area where all of the residents are aware of Dr. King. So in Philadelphia, for example, that street runs through their Central Park where everybody jogs and rides their bikes. But I was speaking recently to a African-American woman who is a curator, a museum curator. And she, when she was looking at my work, said jokingly, well, you know, we say if you're on Martin Luther King, then you know you're in the ghetto.
Anita, you are nodding.
Well, it's a joke that Chris Rock tells, the comedian, that Martin Luther King stood for peace and nonviolence. But if you go and you find a Martin Luther King Boulevard in any city, there's a lot of violence, you know, and generally that's in the black communities, you know, where you find these streets. So, yes, that is it's like an ongoing joke that happens. And a lot of people don't, a lot of African-Americans also do not want to get into that particular joke aspect of a renaming situation.
I mean, it's hard. It's such a hard thing because the problem isn't that the street is called Martin Luther King Boulevard. The problems obviously are larger forces than that.
Absolutely. You know,
well, my understanding is wanting the street in those neighborhoods is to bring inspiration to the residents. And what I observed, what I ended up photographing, was the ongoing references to Martin Luther King. So beautiful murals of Dr. King, of his, quotes from his speeches being used as inspiration. But I understand the other side of the argument. There, I thought it was interesting, Anita, when you said that you thought it was significant, the significance of not having a street named for Dr. King. I hadn't thought about that before. I think it's also significant that some cities skirt the whole issue by renaming a section of the freeway.
How is that skirting the issue?
Well, they don't have to argue about which neighborhood it's going to run through. You know, in some cities, when it comes to renaming a street, and of course, renaming a street after a civil rights leader is far more problematic than naming a street after George Washington. And so they skirt the argument by renaming a section of the freeway, which everybody calls by its number anyway. But I think it's also significant where the street is to some extent. So in my experience, Port Arthur, Texas. The only way I knew I was on Martin Luther King was because my GPS told me so. There were no street signs. Now, I don't know.
Sounds like certainly not a big statue or commemorative banner or something.
No, they renamed the street and then somebody took down the street signs.
Whoa.
And now maybe there never were any, you know, I don't know the history of that. So I think that tells you something about the attitude of the city. But even in a city like Portland, Oregon, Portland is a fairly liberal city. There was a great deal of argument when that street was being renamed. And there was a great deal of argument from the business owners on the street. They used the argument that they had was, first of all, the cost of changing their address. So all of their printed matter has to be redone. But also the concern, going back to that joke, of that their customers would be afraid to come there with fear that it was a dangerous neighborhood.
You know, I want to bring in some other people, but Anita, quickly, why don't you take this up?
Well, this is the highway situation. You have to understand, during the late 40s and 50s, there was a big land grab all over the United States in black communities where they were going to build these highways. So they went in and by eminent domain literally stole the homes of thousands and thousands of African Americans. And generally where you'll find those highway signs is over the highway where these communities used to be. So that's some of the information that is just incredible to know. Vine Street was changed during the 1940s, I believe it was. It was either 40s or 50s, because the name Vine Street was synonymous with African-American community here in Kansas City. As you get to 24th and Vine, it veers off and turns into Lynn for those same reasons that business people who were not African-American did not want to be associated with the names. So those are some of the things that we still deal with historically.
Let's talk with Janet calling us from Kansas City North. Hi, Janet.
Hi, yeah. Boy, what you just brought up there about the Vine Street and et cetera is just, geez, you know, can't really find words for. I agree with so many of the things I've been hearing. First of all, that why don't we have multiple locations, sites, as well as a road or two or whatever, but I like the idea of the park a whole lot. I like the idea what I'm hearing about murals and quotations, you know, a special place.
But also, by murals and quotations, you mean whatever we choose, making sure that it goes beyond just the name, that there's something you can see.
Yeah, I think so. Why not? You know, why can't we have multiple locations that have to do with Martin Luther King? And to the people who do seem to be very intent on wanting to name the Paseo after him. I haven't heard yet anyone say, why don't we call it Martin Luther King's Paseo, his way? I mean, it would kind of symbolize, too, his path and the things that he tried to teach everybody that most of us still don't pay attention to. You know, it would be, but I also like the idea of an east-west, but so I guess I'm not helping very much, but I do think that we need multiple indicators, you know, and I really, really like the idea of a park as part of that.
Well, thank you, Janet.
And other things, maybe a fountain too, you know.
Thank you.
It's way past time that we do the right thing.
Well, thank you, Janet. And I also want to bring in Jerry from Kansas City, Missouri. Jerry, what did you want to share?
Yes, when I was growing up, Paseo was known as El Paseo. I guess that kind of dates me, or ages me. And it was a beautiful boulevard that was named in honor of the most beautiful boulevard in Mexico City, and was a homage to our Hispanic heritage. And to change that would be detracting from the Hispanic community. I think there is a beautiful boulevard that MLK would probably be honored to have named after him, that was named after a U.S. senator from Missouri that was a primary mover for Manifest Destiny and the displacement of our First Nations throughout the West. And that would be the Benton Boulevard. It's a beautiful boulevard, and it seems to me that Senator Benton has had enough homage for the things that he's done to the American natives, and that might be a more appropriate change. And it's through the integrated neighborhoods, and it's a beautiful boulevard, and it's been well maintained. And I would think that it would be a nice thing for MLK to have named after him.
Well, Anita, I have a feeling your response to this might be similar to the proposal of renaming some things currently named after J.C. Nichols.
I'm in total agreement with removing Confederate statues and various things that has had their time. I didn't consider Benton and the Santa Fe neighborhoods and things, because they had restricted covenants at one time where you could not sell to African Americans and various things like that. So I think you have an option role in there, and one that we could securely, like you said, it's a beautiful situation. My uncle was one of the first African Americans in the late 50s and early 60s to purchase a home on Benton Boulevard, which actually motivated quite a bit of white flight from that area. So I think that's an option right there, personally.
Let's talk to Joe in Independence. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was just talking to a producer, and my question was, why don't we name like a place with a historical connection to Dr. King?
So, and you're thinking maybe a place where he visited or something like that?
Yeah.
You know, Anita, this is kind of similar to what you were suggesting earlier in the show, but what do we know, I guess, locally about places that Martin Luther King visited, or, you know, like that would have had that really direct kind of connection?
Well, you know, besides St. Stephen's Baptist Church, where Marcus Garvey and another, you know, you can make that statement, you could make that case for just about any place if you're talking about Martin Luther King, you know, because in my mind, his words resonated way beyond where he might have stood. But I'm thinking the route of the riots and the reasons for the riots and the Central High School route that took is a much better understanding, because we'd be able to do a lot, like the woman said, with the signage. We'd be able to do a lot with the tours, the education. You know, I see a lot of teachers struggling in February to understand more about Black history. What if you were able to speak to the people that actually walked the route, the high schoolers and various things?
And I want to just say, Anita, you've been behind significant efforts to honor local civil rights activists and get more interest in local civil rights sites where things happened. And of course, you can honor national figures and local figures. But is there a parallel movement to name streets after Kansas Cityans who were part of the civil rights movement?
I wish there were. I wish there was more of an understanding of what these people's role were when they heard the words of the Martin Luther Kings and the Malcolm X's and, you know, the various people who were, you know, Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, the people who were in the front lines. I wish there was more of that.
Anita Dixon, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Susan Berger, photographer of MLK Boulevards Nationwide, thank you.
Thank you.
In just a minute, Kansas City Royals reporter Maria Torres joins us in the studio. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a question you are dying to ask her. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now Maria Torres is here. She's the young new Royals reporter for the Kansas City Star, doing a lot of people's dream job, getting paid to watch baseball games, talk to Royals players, and write about it. Maria, I'm sure my description of your job doesn't oversimplify it at all.
Not at all, no.
Well, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Gina.
Have you always wanted to cover sports and baseball in particular?
Baseball in particular, for sure. After I graduated high school, I knew I loved writing. I knew I loved baseball. So I figured, why not give it a shot? So that's how it kind of worked out.
It is such a male-dominated field. And I'm not just talking about sports reporting. You know, the people on the teams, the people you're covering,
sure.
That's men. It's, of course, like, awesome that you are a woman doing this job. I'm curious about whether you saw other women doing jobs like this, or if this felt like a bold direction to take.
I think I was fortunate enough that by the time I was growing up, there were a lot of women who'd already broken past the barrier and gotten into the locker room. So I did have people like that to look up to. And then once I got to college, I had a professor, her name is Vicki Michaelis. She was a USA Today sports. She covered the Olympics. She covered the Nuggets and the Denver Post before that. So I was fortunate to have her as a mentor and kind of guide us and, you know, give me some direction there.
So your spur of the moment trip to cover the really shocking death of Yordano Ventura, that was a big deal. Talk to me about that experience.
Which part?
Yeah. Take me back to the beginning.
Okay. Well, as you know, I mean, we have a lot of talented people at the Star, especially who work in the sports department. So it was just kind of a big team effort. And as it so happened, like, I'm fluent in Spanish, grew up speaking it in my house. So it worked out that I got to just get in on the ground level and start to report from through, you know, like media in the Dominican Republic and reach out to people who were around Ventura as he was, you know, living in the Dominican. So, that just kind of helped cross that barrier.
I really admire the stories that came out of your reporting there. And I would love it if you could read just the beginning of one of those stories, because it really took me to the place where this happened in such a visceral way. Like, you definitely had to go there to write it this way.
Sure. Okay. Ascending into the clouds, abruptly spiraling downward and weaving through cratered floodplains, the 30-mile road from San Jose de Ocoa to Juan Adrian is widely known to be treacherous. A local will tell you that 50 people have died in the last year on the second half of the route from Rancho Arriba, a number at which authorities scoff even while acknowledging the death toll rises routinely. The passage is rife with every sort of caution sign. They plead with drivers to honk their horns moving into blind curves and implore them to slow down and get in low gear and turn lights on even by daylight and proteja su vida, protect your life, by wearing seatbelts. It's not a secret that it's a dangerous road, said Colonel Diego Pesqueira of the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, adding, it is a road people know they shouldn't drive after dark. Yet on this unforgiving highway, largely unlit and shrouded in fog, here drove a heedless Yordano Ventura between approximately 3 and 5 a.m. on January 22nd.
Maria, I mean, what did that trip and that reporting experience mean to you?
I never would have imagined that I would do something like that, be involved in something like this. And, Vahe Gregorian, who's the columnist, he and I were, you know, reporting all of this together, along with Jill Toyoshiba, too. And it was just such a group effort. Everyone was, like, constantly bouncing ideas off of each other. And one of the really cool experiences about this is as the native Spanish speaker, since I was the only one, we kind of had some built-in time to like pause and let me like go back to like in the middle of conversations with sources, let me go back to Vahe and be like, okay, this is what they said. Where should we go next? And it was really unique in that way. And helpful to me as like a young reporter, just to like see how, someone like Vahe would be thinking and, you know, learning and, you know, just learning the process, but just, you know, as far as like actually going to the Dominican and seeing all of this, I mean, I wish I could put it in like better words, like what I'm trying to say here, but no. It was just kind of incredible.
Tell me more about your background as a native Spanish speaker and how you think that will influence your coverage of the Royals, or if you think that's an important part of covering the Royals.
I definitely think it is. There aren't as many Latino players this year as there have been in the past, but there's still a few. And one thing I think that helps is like I feel like I have kind of a common background with them. And it sometimes like if they're like speaking in Spanish, I mean, in English, sorry, to like other journalists, and maybe they'll say something and in English, it doesn't really quite sound right. But I can kind of pick up like, OK, oh, you meant like, you know, this is what you're trying to say. And, you know, as far as like my background, I was born in Puerto Rico. My parents are Dominican and Puerto Rican. And growing up in my house, I mean, we lived in Florida and Georgia, so I didn't really live in the Caribbean or anything like that. But that's what we spoke all the time. So, you know, I think I still need to brush up on it. I'm sure if you asked any of the Latino players, they'd be like, oh, you know, she needs a little bit of work on the Spanish, but I get by.
When did you find out that you would be taking over as the Star's designated Royals reporter?
Sure. That was about... it's almost May now, right? So we're like beginning of March. Yeah, so it hasn't been very long at all.
Yeah. Can you take me back to that moment and what that was like?
Yeah, I mean, it was just kind of hectic. There were a lot of moving pieces involved, and the way that it worked out, it was just like, all right, I mean, it's your turn now. I mean, I think like if we were talking like 3 months ago, I would have told you, okay. I mean, obviously this is what my goal is, but I thought I was still a couple of years away. So it just kind of like ramped up. It was just kind of like, all right, you're going to do this now. And I was like, all right.
Has actually doing it been what you imagined?
Yeah. And it has been. And I think the cool part is, cool is probably not the best word, but I think what I've really enjoyed is just really being around the team every day and starting to really build like better relationships with people. Cause I did cover the Royals a little bit last year, but it wasn't like as in depth as I would now. So like, you know, it's a lot easier to just kind of have like commonplace conversations that aren't all just about, just for a story. Like it feels more organic that way.
Well, you still have just a little time to call and ask Maria Torres a question about being the new beat reporter on the covering the Royals for the Kansas City Star. The number is 816-235-2888. You know, so I asked this question on Twitter as well, and I've got a couple of people who have questions for you, like, if you hit a home run, how would you nickname yourself?
Can I go with M-Dog? That's like the best that I could come up with. Although I have friends who call me M-Cat. I'm like, nah, M-Cat doesn't work for me. M-Dog.
Okay. We also have, let's see, and I'm going to admit something. I'm not super like... I'm not an expert in sports. We'll put it that way.
That's okay.
So I don't actually understand the question I am about to ask you on behalf of a Twitter user, Iconoclast of Things, who asks, pace of play solutions, are they a good idea or is it much hand-wringing about nothing?
I definitely think it's much hand-wringing about nothing. I think someone pointed out the other day, like Brandon Belt's 21 pitch at bat. How does that help pace? I mean, that doesn't help pace of play, but there's literally nothing you could do to control it. I mean, someone's going to put together a good at bat, like let them. I mean, that's how it's going to be. So the other thing is just, between innings, like cutting down like a couple of seconds for pitchers to, you know, throw that one last pitch like for warm up. It's just, I think in the end, that's probably going to hurt the player more than it's going to help the fan base, so to speak. So I don't know. I think it's a lot of hand-wringing about nothing.
Can you tell me more about your own background with baseball, maybe as a fan?
Sure. I grew up in Atlanta. So I started watching baseball. The first time I went to a baseball game actually was because in seventh grade, I got a four pack of free tickets to go see the Braves. And I think I'm pretty sure it was the Mets. It was Braves and Mets. I may be idealizing it because Braves and Mets is a big rivalry. It also could have been like Braves and Diamondbacks, who knows. My family and I, we all went, sat in like some, you know, like nosebleed seats and just kind of like took in the atmosphere. And like the thing that really stands out to us still is that like there was a family, it was a Sunday afternoon, there was a family who was having brunch in the stands and like they were passing around a carton of hard boiled eggs and we were just cracking up. So that wasn't like really big into like the whole baseball part, but it was just kind of like the atmosphere of the event. And I think that was probably my first like sporting event too. So it was just kind of cool to like be brought into that moment. And from then on, I was just kind of hooked.
Do you, thinking about the Royals in particular, is there something about covering that team, Kansas City's team, that you think would be different from covering any other team?
I'm not completely sure if I could speak from a lot of experience, but they feel kind of unique to me in a certain regard. Like, just the people in the organization are very... they're very helpful. Everyone's very polite. Everyone's nice. It's kind of like, they're kind of very open in a way. And I don't know if that would be the same in other markets.
What have you learned about the team by watching them so closely this season that maybe you didn't quite realize before or appreciate? Have you learned anything that you feel like this closer look has really let you in on?
I don't know if I could really, maybe a little harder for me to answer. One thing, I mean, I've taken away from this experience is like, they are all very plugged in. I think they really do believe that they can turn things around and put together a good season. Just that right now they're kind of scuffling, but they all believe in each other. And I think that's pretty big. Like they're not turning their backs on each other or, yelling at someone for doing something poorly or something like that.
As someone who reports on a specific team for a specific sport, you're kind of returning to the same people, to the same subjects again and again. Do you feel like you're becoming friends with the Royals players?
I wouldn't say friends, but I do think like I said earlier, it just becomes everyone becomes a little bit more familiar with you. And that really does help a ton as far as, you know, building relationships and hopefully in the long run, starting to write better stories.
Let's talk to Ray in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Ray.
Hey.
Hi, Ray.
Good morning. First of all, congratulations on your new position. I'm sure it's very exciting. I am wondering about your craft a little bit. Do you write your stories while the game is happening, or do you take notes and then write it afterwards, or is it some combination of that?
It's a combination of them, for sure. Definitely have to write during the game, because we want to publish a game story as soon as it's done, as soon as the game itself is done, I mean. But then there's always room for improvement after those initial game stories are done. So I go back and reference notes and just kind of rewrite things that are in the original story and try to add more to it as we go along. So that way the final version is the best that it can be. Does that answer your question?
That's very interesting. I appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. Thanks, Ray.
Thanks, Ray. Let's talk to Tom in Parkville. Hi, Tom.
Good morning.
Hey, Tom.
This is just a really great pleasure to be able to congratulate you on your new position.
Thanks, Tom. I appreciate that.
You're very welcome. Well, here's the thing. I've been a Kansas City Royals fan for 50 years, ever since they've come to Kansas City. And they've been up and down and all over the place. But the recent last 5 or 10 years, they've been getting into a lot of statistical stuff. Like last night's our pitcher was 106 miles an hour off the bat.
Gosh, right.
Amazing stuff. But now I got a silly question.
Okay.
What does batting average, RBIs, those are things that are alphabet soup from decades.
Mm-hmm.
What does OPS stand for? I see it on the screen all the time, but I don't understand what it means.
Yeah, OPS is on base plus slugging percentage, so it just kind of gives you a better idea of how much a player is actually producing and helping the team. Does that help?
Well, I have a sense of what that is, but I keep hearing on base percentage, but
OPS.
But I'm just looking at the B. The B is missing out of OPS, is what it sounds like.
That's right. Yeah, they didn't want to make it too long. OBPS sounds kind of, I guess that's kind of clunky.
Okay, very good. So OPS is the on-base percentage, but it's a different acronym.
OPS is on-base percentage plus slugging percentage.
All right, so for the casual baseball watcher, that tells you how much someone is actually producing, you were saying?
Yeah, so on-base percentage will explain like just how often a player reaches base. And then slugging percentage explains how much power this player has. So as far as like driving the ball out of the ballpark for a home run, doubles and triples. So you combine those things and you kind of get a better sense of what a player is doing, because things like slugging percentage won't take into account a player's walk. So a walk doesn't count as an at-bat. So when you put that into an on-base percentage, then you get to see how often he's actually on base, because a batting average does not reflect a walk.
You know, a lot of fans probably fantasize about your job, but I wonder do you feel like you also are a Royals fan? Like in most journalism situations, you're supposed to be objective, right?
Right.
Does it compromise you if you're a Royals fan? And are you a Royals fan?
I'm sorry to say that I am not a Royals fan, so to speak. But I that doesn't mean that I don't, you know, enjoy watching this team or covering this team. So I can't really answer the question about whether or not it compromises my perspective of the team, because I've never really felt that way about it.
Really? Do you have a team you do feel that way about?
Outside of baseball or just in baseball?
In baseball, yeah.
In baseball. I mean, I still root for the Braves. Like, I still care about what goes on in Atlanta. And I'm really excited to see what Ronald Acuna will do today. He's being promoted to the major leagues. He's a big-time prospect. It'll be really fun to see that, just as someone who is, you know, from Atlanta and grew up watching a different set of Braves come up and see now new ones coming in is kind of cool. I think it's kind of a similar situation to what's happening in Kansas City.
But what can you quickly tell the Kansas City Royals fans who might be freaking out hearing you say that right now?
I think everything is going to be okay.
yeah. Everything is going to be okay.
Yeah.
Well, Maria Torres, thank you so much.
Thanks, Gina. I appreciate it.
You can listen back to this show or anything you've heard on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, tune in to hear about a kid inventor who has got a high-tech solution to her own fear of thunderstorms. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Matt Groby. We had extra help today from reporter Michelle Tyrene Johnson. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Up to Date is next.